I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Well, it's a very great pleasure to be here, although I have to confess, and I think Pankaj feels the same about this, that I'm really nervous because I haven't really seen an embodied audience for quite a long time. a year, maybe more. And so please don't behave too much like humans because we may not know what to do. But I'm very, very happy to be here and particularly happy to be talking to Pankaj about his new novel. That's because I really, really, really enjoyed it. And it gave me the kind of pleasure that I associate with reading 19th century fiction of the best kind, of course, mostly French. Like Balzac and Flaubert, and there's very much something of the Bildungsroman, the sentimental education, political, social education, the young man moving through not only school and university, but the world. And I read the book in that way. And what's interesting about that kind of book, this kind of book, is that it gives you not only the life of, in this case, the narrator and his good friends, and eventually a woman, but also the society around them and the kinds of interactions that take place, which have to do with class, center and periphery, politics, and in the case of India and what Pankaj is covering, the whole move from a society which in many ways was traditional and caught up in caste as well as class and empire to world of finance, capital, and I guess what populist religion in the case of Modi. It's a very rich book. But the first thing I want to ask Pankaj, because of course, like the rest of you, I've been reading his other books that aren't fiction in the interim. And I too have moved occasionally between fiction and non-fiction. But I wanted to know what it meant for you, Pankaj, to go back to the fictional form after so many years doing other things, other kinds of writing.
Thank you, Lisa. First of all, also let me say what an honor it is to be discussing this book with you. Now, obviously, I've been reading you, like many people here, for years and years. So I was especially delighted to know that you liked this book, liked it enough at least to discuss it here. I've been toying with different answers to that question over the last couple of weeks because I've been doing some publicity around it. And something I read just yesterday, just randomly reading for a piece I have to write, and I came across a remark by Rudyard Kipling. Says, when you know you can do something else. And that was roughly my experience with journalism or the kind of books I've been writing or the kind of pieces or essays I've been writing. I'd begun to feel that there was no real challenges involved in doing many of those pieces. That even when I was being asked to, expand my knowledge or go to another place or learn about it, what I was producing was still too formulaic. It was following the formula of the magazine story, of the magazine essay, and that there wasn't enough of a creative challenge there, whether it's the reportage or book of intellectual history or or even the memoir, which is, you know, probably the most capacious form in terms of accommodating emotional realities or moral lives. So I felt really, I mean, fiction I was drawn to during all these years while I was writing nonfiction, always, you know, seduced by books of fiction. I was reading them all this time, sometimes writing about them. And then I felt, you know, over 20 years, I had accumulated an experience that I could not describe in nonfiction, you know. And I felt
that's what we want to hear about. We want to hear what you couldn't describe in the nonfiction.
Yes, and those were, you know, those were things you just could not do in nonfiction, you know, like describing the inner lives of people who had made, you just pointed out in your introduction, made this massive socioeconomic leap from one century to another, really, in terms of material growth, in terms of the freedoms that were suddenly available to them, professional freedoms, sexual freedoms, the freedom of mobility, you know, people born in one particular part of India, suddenly, you know, traveling all over the world, owning multiple houses across the world. This was all really, for many of us, a bewildering experience. And there was no way nonfiction could get at it, could describe that, what happens to the lives of people, by which I mean their lives as sons, husbands, lovers, brothers, sisters, what kind of transformations are affected in private lives. And so, you know, I had to sort of go back to fiction. And there were other motives too. I mean, there were vast aspects of my own experience, for instance, growing up in small railway towns that I'd never touched, that I'd never really written about, you know, partly because there wasn't much of an opportunity in the nonfiction work I was doing. So I wanted to go back to that, recapture certain moments from those years, which in a way feel particularly distant now, much more distant than they actually are. You know, it's only 30, 40 years ago that those experiences occurred. But because of the massive changes in India, they feel like they happened a century ago. This world I'm describing, where there was no television, no cinema, or there was cinema, very, very infrequent. The only mean of communication was the radio or the newspapers that arrived a day late from Delhi. So a completely different world. And that's also something living now in this sort of hyper-connected world I wanted to rediscover for myself. So that was another kind of motivation among several others.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, it struck me reading this that you yourself were discovering things as you were writing, because fiction allows you to do that, that you can see the things that you love and hate within the same person and within the same set of circumstances, so that you almost end up changing your mind. I mean, I know when I write fiction, quite often it's the person I least understand that I get closest to in the writing, because that's what you really want to discover. And sometimes it's the people you like the least that you discover the most about.
Absolutely true. I mean, there is quite a well-known line by V.S. Naipaul, how autobiography always conceals and fiction always reveals. And I think what he means by this is when you're writing fiction, you're revealing aspects of yourself that even you were not really truly aware of. And I think, you know, that's one of the miraculous or exhilarating things about writing fiction, is that it allows you to confront these different selves. Not all of them pleasant, not all of them ones you would like to own up to. But nevertheless, you know, it's that encounter that also makes fiction writing so mysterious and rewarding at the same time. And again, I mean, this was a new experience for me, because in nonfiction, you just never have that kind of experience. You know, your facts around which you're going to build your narrative are given to you, or you acquire them through travel or through reading, and then you construct a narrative around those particular facts. But this process or endeavor of digging stuff out of yourself that you weren't even aware existed was definitely, for me, something new. And it was such a long time ago that I wrote my first novel, it felt like something new.
Well, Well, it's interesting too, because the characters, in a sense, engage in politics and change. So there are three main male characters in this book who are friends at university, and the narrator is one of those. And I think the scene you're going to read for us, which comes early in the book, we thought Pankaj would do a reading, which I haven't heard him do before, actually takes him back to his childhood and to an India which, well, some of you may know, I certainly don't know.
So I'm going to read from a chapter which occurs early in the narrative, and it's about the narrator's childhood, of him growing up in a small town with an extremely aggressive father, very abusive father, in fact, who sells essentially tea and samosas from a railway stall, from a stall on a railway station. He returns home late in the evening, having sold off his samosas to the last of the trains, and carefully notes the day's takings in a notebook of ruled paper. The station, desolate for most of the day, is transformed by many explosions of energy when the trains emerge, breathily roaring and coughing around the bend at a level crossing. The black engines with cow catchers that appear demonic with splayed metal teeth, but turn out to trail some tame wooden carriages, and with a short desperate shriek and grinding of brakes, shudder to a standstill. The platform suddenly starts to seethe, and Baba needs several arms to meet the hands proffering coins and sweat-soiled notes across the counter, grabbing biscuits, samosas, and pan, while speedily counting cash and then throwing it into a greasy drawer below his shelves. He seems briefly to dance. The long-stalked fans circling overhead seem more helpless. Great billowing whirls of steam shroud one part of the platform in white. Gray mail bags heaved out of the guard van land with loud thugs, and the dogs start to howl. Business is conducted mostly during these interludes of extreme disorder, which is abruptly heightened to a frenzy by the thin, keen blast of the station master's silver whistle and the waving of the guard's tattered green flag. Silence descends rapidly after the trains take their bad temper to the countryside. The rhythmic creak and whine of the hand pump can be heard again on the platform. But my father is fuming as he distributes his unsold samosas to the station's perennially hungry residents. Suddenly tired of the recipients of his charity shoving and swearing at each other, his arm leaps out in the crowd of ragged faces and cuffs someone on the ear or cheek. Back home, he likes to complain about the weather. Kaisa mausam hai ye? What kind of weather is this? The sweepers who fail to show up for work, nikamme bhangi mufti kamai hai ye Harijan karmchari ki. They're all freeloaders, these Harijan employees. The occasional peasant who dares to hawk roasted corn cobs and sliced cucumbers at the station, and Muslims in general. Ye Muhammad log bahut kattar hain. These Muhammadans are such fanatics. His most favored target is corruption, and it is true that hardly a day passes without some kind of swindle. The merchants who sell him weevil-infested flour and withered beetle leaves, the chokra vendors of his chai who hide their true earnings as nimbly as they balance rows of nesting clay cups on their arms, the stealthy gamblers in black overalls who leave smudges of coal on his playing cards and don't pay him the right commission, and even customers passing on torn currency, they all try it on. The engine drivers and linesmen and signalmen steal coal. The contractor for railway laborers inflates his invoices. But he, a swindler himself, underpaying the underage boys he employs, is really complaining about his own life and the lives of so many men like him. Being shoved around by the station master, who incessantly berates him for dirtying the platform, the local thanedar who demands his own share of the tiny commission from the gamblers, the junior staff at the government hospital miles away, who keeps him waiting for hours for a blood test, the Brahmin teachers at primary school who openly condescend to him, as though guessing at his low-caste origins from his obsequiousness before them, and even the clerk at the post office, who, while gently tearing along the perforated edge of the Gandhi face stamps behind a dusty grill, snaps at him.
It's a wonderful, wonderful portrait of the father in the book, the father of the narrator, Aaron. And the father himself has a very interesting trajectory. And I don't know whether you just want to tell us a little bit about that, because having managed to send his son to school, tell us a little about what...
Well, I mean, his
in political terms, if you don't want to give away plot.
His dream is of social mobility, and it's a dream that he shares with tens of millions of people. His dream is of getting as far away as possible from this life of degradation and humiliation he has been born to. And he sees his son really as a ticket out of this particular life. He's also managed to pass off his son as a Brahmin. And this is, again, a very commonplace practice. So you just change the surname on a school certificate and give your son a different surname, although he himself belongs to a low caste. So all these sort of particular attempts to somehow break free of this life of humiliation that he has to suffer, and then of course we see him later in the present when he is in his 80s and he's turned into this very rabid supporter of Hindu nationalism. In fact, he's the only character of that kind that exists in the novel, someone with very pronounced political views of the kind that have become very notorious.
And it's a wonderful transformation, of course, not one that I particularly anticipated, because why would I think that?
Well, I mean, I think, again, you know, obviously fiction has its own logic and its own momentum, but I do think that for a lot of people, this particular regime has offered a way to express their humiliation, the sense of humiliation. How do they express it? How do they express it? They express it by finding people to hate, the metropolitan liberals, the English-speaking liberals. And this is what the demagogues in India today have successfully accomplished, is to give many people who've lived lives of extreme meanness, of extreme degradation, someone to hate, someone to despise, or someone to blame for that plight. Their lives have not materially improved, certainly not to the extent that they had hoped. But what has been given to them is this very seductive enemy. This enemy you can be obsessed with, and you can spend your days and nights hating that particular enemy. And yeah, I thought of his father as one of the many, many, many people.
It was very interesting to me to see that, because I'm interested in emotion, that one of the perhaps almost primary emotions that recur in all the characters is this sense of humiliation, a kind of shame, whether it's vis-a-vis caste or class or a kind of idealized version of other people's lives. And just tell us a little bit more about that in terms of the other characters as well, and India, perhaps America, perhaps Britain, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I mean, this is not a subject I could really go much into in my nonfiction, but I do think this is an underexplored subject. The sense of humiliation that many people live with, which is exacerbated even as they experience, you know, rapid social mobility, even as they move out of, say, a low caste or a low class and become rich. But these early injuries inflicted on them when they are young leave very deep, very, very deep scars. And so they are really, in that sense, deeply tormented people. And that torment manifests itself in all kinds of ways in their public lives, in their private lives. I think one reason why it has not been much covered, I'm just speculating here, is because we have bought into, in the last three decades, into the ideology of meritocracy and the idea that social mobility is possible. You know, the line that is often repeated in the book, that you are nothing, but you can become something. So once you become something, you can break free of that past, and you can leave it behind. So there is this expectation that we are all now, you know, essentially belonging to, if not exactly a post-racial society, you know, also an idea that was much mooted after 2008, after Obama's election, that we're moving towards a classless society of some kind, where people deploying their merit or their talents in the best way possible can achieve these or get to these summits of prosperity and stability, and things will be fine from then on. But I think these particular feelings of feeling shame because you speak English with the wrong accent, because of certain lack of cultural capital, because you've not heard of certain books, because you've not heard of certain restaurant rituals, these work invisibly upon people in ways that I don't think, I mean, I feel political psychology or sociology hasn't really begun to reckon with. It forms a kind of, you know, somewhat sort of marginal aspect of intellectual inquiry. But, you know, again, it's only in fiction that you can explore this properly. Just what does that lingering sense of humiliation does to people in the long term?
So you begin one of the earliest sort of set pieces in the book is the scene when the three main characters meet at school, university, at this Institute of Technology. And this is their path to freedom and financial success, but it's also a place where shame is inflicted on them. So there's a kind of double whammy already going on in there. Tell us a little bit about these characters, because one of them you're going to read a little bit about, but one of them doesn't come in our reading, in your readings. And I'm very interested in him because he's the writer, Asim. And I thought he was an extraordinary character. So tell us about him.
Well, the
three men, this is one of them.
So there are two male friends, and actually three of them, but two much, much, much closer. And the character Lisa is referring to is someone who also goes to the Indian Institute of Technology, but then decides to become a writer, and then first becomes a journalist, and then becomes a novelist. Very sure of himself, very confident, also comes from, has a very modest background. And he grows up, like all of these characters, just at the right time, late 80s, early 90s, when it was possible for a lot of young Indians to suddenly avail of the opportunities being opened up by globalization, by increased sort of travel, much better communications. So, you know, they were able to read a lot, they were able to travel a great deal. And he's one of those people who embraces all those opportunities and sees them as essentially also soon available to other people around him. So in other words, someone who completely believes in the modern ideology of progress, of self-expansion, of self-assertion, and continuously harps on this theme to his friends, to other people. And a large part of his self-image is his sort of notion of sexual freedom, how India is becoming sexually more free and more open, and this is a good thing. We are connecting back to our older traditions. And he turns into a sort of cultural impresario, a magazine editor, a novelist, someone who also hosts literary festivals and intellectual festivals. And again, I mean, I think I've observed several of these trajectories over the last three decades or so. And it's been fascinating to see just how, even at the height of fulfillment, even when you've achieved everything, you've got every kind of celebrity under the same roof. You've got Hollywood film stars, Bollywood film stars, the world's greatest writers, and yet something is missing. So this whole particular trajectory, which is so tragic in many ways, this sort of, you know, this very honorable attempt to leave behind a life of degradation, but then this embrace of prosperity and new sexual freedoms also turns into a very darkly ambiguous affair. And so fulfillment again then becomes this, you know, project that is not going to be so easily realized. And this is again, you know, this is again a sort of experience that has that I've observed, indeed I've observed it in my own life, which, you know, made me think of just how many different modes of ambiguity are concealed by the kind of broader discourse about the rise of India or the rise of China. What is actually happening in people's lives, even as they make these spectacular journeys from destitution to, you know, heading Silicon Valley companies.
So it's not giving away too much, since it happens on the first two pages. If I say something, ask a question around something which is actually a punchline. But the way you structure the book, it's actually an address from the narrator, Arun, whose father we have just met, writing to the one central woman of the book, Aliya, who is also a would-be writer and Muslim. And she is attempting to write a book about the circle around the third of these young men, whom we haven't yet met, a man called Virindra, have I got that right, who is in jail after having made a lot of money in America. And Arun is going to tell her about their real lives, not the ones that she can pick up either from his best but rivalrous friend and the papers and so on. So it's a very interesting way to structure a novel, as a kind of letter to an addressee that you meet in various ways in the book, and who becomes the principal love object, if you like, or love subject of the heroes, the narrators. And I was wondering why you chose it, because in a sense it allows for confession, but it's also because it's got an addressee to whom things need to be proved. It's not quite a confession. It's very interesting. Tell us.
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, I mean, I think it was important for me to make Arun the narrator, because I wanted it to be a novel of consciousness, really, a novel of sensibility. And Arun seemed to me like the kind of character who's not political, who's not part of this world that he's describing, who's on the margins. And also importantly, he's a translator. I feel like translators occupy a very unique position. They're obviously indispensable. And at the same time, they're invisible. And I felt that this is an interesting position for Arun to occupy in this narrative. But then there was the problem of what event forces him to break out of his natural reticence. He's a very withdrawn, self-effacing character. So he had to be, in a way, provoked into speech by something that happens to him. And once I sort of could figure that out, I could also see that addressing the book to someone who's writing about somewhat similar things, but from a journalistic perspective, might actually, first of all, be a very economical way of narrating the story, leaving out, whole chunks that are not germane, that are not at all needed, really, but, in a more realistic form, or a more conventional form, you'd be, spending a lot of time scene setting, introducing characters and so on. And here you could just talk to somebody and tell them about things. So that, all of that, in a way, sort of helped me get away from the big, blockbuster novel about three decades and three friendships, which is not a novel, I could have written, or not a novel that I enjoy reading. I mean, it was sort of just allowed me to cover a lot of ground.
The one that Asim would have written, right?
Definitely the kind of novel Asim would have written, full of all kinds of extremely well-researched detail, about every aspect of the caste situation in India, everything, all the political, sociological data, very carefully processed and put together. But that was not the novel that I was interested in doing, not even a kind of political novel. I was not interested in writing an explicitly political novel of the kind that Asim would write. I felt the politics, whatever there is of politics, and what is there of politics? I think politics in this novel is essentially the presence of ideas and ideologies, presence or maybe ideas and ideologies pressing down more upon the individuals described in this book than, say, a character in some other era. I mean, I think we all realize now, three decades of intense ideology, and they have shaped, determined our lives in all kinds of ways. And I think a political novel is one that registers those pressures. And I think in that sense, it's a political novel.
I mean, I wanted you to read this, but you didn't choose to. So can I read it out loud?
Please.
Just because it sort of makes sense here. And this to me felt like a kind of the underlying, it's not big politics, small politics underlying the book, and seemed to me very interesting in the context, because he, narrator, writing to a girlfriend who is a Pat's girlfriend, who is a journalist and who's very, very much a figure within the Twitter sphere, the social media. And so an interesting kind of modern character. I mean, far more modern than me, for example. You know, it strikes me as being very modern. And he says, I've forgotten where it is, from what I had seen of non-white people, starting with my libtard obsessed father, it seemed prudent to fear that whatever their skin color, the poor and oppressed today were very likely to be persecutors tomorrow, even sooner. I remember arguing with you, that is Aliyah, about this, how phrases such as intersectionality and broader struggle against patriarchy that you used in your tweets didn't quite account for the fact that some brave protesters against tyranny in Tahrir Square could turn, given the chance, into rapists. This comes at a moment of disillusionment for the hero, in a sense, so that's part of it. But it also seemed to me to make sense of a lot of the things that had come before. And in some ways underpinned what happens to Asim and to Arun. I don't want to give away what happens to Arun because it's very interesting. But if you open the book behind you and show us the fly leaves, oh, there, you've got it. Just open it because it's so beautiful. Come on, you've got to buy this, everybody. Look at that. Our hero, our narrator, ends up there, I think. I've never been, so I don't know. But somewhere that looks like that. So I think we should read the second section because we're going to have a lot of questions from you and everybody out there as well. Perhaps just, do you want to comment on what I've just read?
Yes, I think probably Arun is better placed to comment on that than I am. But I suppose, you know, if you look at the world that he finds himself in, I should also say that he, at some point in the novel, he ends up in London, where he comes across members and representatives of the metropolitan left or the metropolitan liberals who are very worked up about Brexit and about, they're all Remainers, of course. And he sort of assesses them. He listens to their conversations from his own particular perspective of political disorder and injustice and is often very critical of them as he is in this particular instance. So it's very much, I feel like, you know, I obviously kept a very clear distance from him because I belong to that metropolitan formation in many ways.
It's a self-critique as well.
It's a kind of self-critique. You know, the novel also does that. It offers you a platform for self-critique, which you cannot really do in fiction without overcommitting yourself and without being aligned with this or that. And then, of course, you know, the polemical exchanges that follow fix you even more or in one position or other, whereas fiction allows you that space to bring all kinds of conversations and perspectives into play, all kinds of ideas into conversation with each other. I mean, you know, I think I would like to think that someone with his background would indeed observe the metropolitan left in this manner and see just how, in many ways, disconnected they are from, say, the reality of North England. You know, it's all right to be Remainers, of course. So am I. But you know, there is something else going on that they're not aware of or not interested in at all. And so I think, you know, in many ways, he's also contrasting his own experience with the experiences of the expats or relatively very well-off people that he finds here who have just very recently embraced politics, you know, post-Brexit and post-Trump.
But that's what you're going to read. So I thought it was an interesting segue into this second section, which takes place in London.
So this is an account of his life, a little bit of account of his bit of his life in London. After dinner somewhere, initially at some white draped table with napkin pyramids in a restaurant freshly recommended by the Evening Standard, where waiters opened menus as gingerly as an antiquarian bookseller I knew in Shimla exhibited an overpriced edition of the Illustrated London News, until, in an awkward but necessary conversation, I reminded you that I was comfortably off only by Indian standards. We would take an Uber back, suddenly mute now in its darkness as you checked your social media feeds, often the first reports of the events we had just attended, the loud colors from your screen flowing across your face, whose eager intent always made me a bit jealous. To emerge from the car in your street, the private gardens with high railings on one side and glowing French windows on another, to open the blue front door of your apartment and hear it shut behind us with the oiled click of an expensive lock, to then find ourselves subtly lit in amber in the tall gilt-framed hall mirror and hear the grandfather clock ticking vigilantly was to know security again. At a time when so many of my thoughts and memories were shaded by sorrow and guilt, your old apartment in Kensington, home to several generations of your family, and still suggesting in its renovated state all the great many things said and done inside it, became a kind of reassurance. The space and order and light of its vast, high-ceilinged rooms suggesting a durable fastness against death and separation. During those long London twilights, the windows of even the homes of strangers showcased a reality that seemed to have stood firm and eternal for centuries. A woman lying in an armchair holding a glass of white wine, children reading or playing or drawing, a man taking off his tie, and a cat crawling out between roped back curtains to lounge fatly on a sill. Coming from a society rent by anarchic poverty and cruelty, where you could never feel history to be on your side, or any institution of government and law working in your favor, coming from a society that had frightened and traumatized so many of us for life, I was learning how to appreciate, or at least not be afraid of, a rich and steadfast world. Then too, we avoided living in that part of London, the journeys through terraces of brick, past boarded up shops, cardboard dwellers, and iPhone snatchers, hints to me of a larger dereliction up north, the deindustrialized country about which I knew nothing, except that it had sprung Brexit upon unsuspecting Londoners. How much easier it was in that, yes, uncompromisingly fashionable and reassuringly expensive, watering hole of Russian and Asian oligarchs, where the destitute, unlike India's, slumped in doorways, nearly always out of sight, to enjoy the city's array of parks, restaurants, and bookshops, to experience even things abandoned on the pavements, disemboweled sofas, collapsed hoovers, computer keyboards, as a kind of visual novelty. How lightly our legs skipped over the devout row of shoes on the pavement outside a mosque in Southall, where we had ventured to get your fix of desi khana at a restaurant serving authentically Gujarati food. And how great was the security of the rich tourists that I felt in the Mithai shop with a garlanded portrait of Modi we repaired to afterwards for some rasmalai. The security that those raving about kebab dives and Sufi shrines in seedy old Delhi, my old workplace, always knew. I didn't have to worry anymore about the Indian toilet cleaners at Heathrow. Like Asim in his suite at the Pierre in New York, I had been elevated above the meanness that was the fate of most immigrants to the city. And unlike them, I had in my mind the comforting knowledge that I could go back, that I didn't have to, after all, be here. I envied your intimacy with the city, the confident way you placed yourself in it and professed metropolitan habits. Let's meet at my regular, the LRB bookshop. Unconsciously trying to imitate you, I often found myself making observations that struck my own ears as affected. The best coffee roasters are in Shoreditch. And I suppressed the things that puzzled me, flat white coffee, orchids, rare and expensive in my mind, available at tube station florists, and the numerous white young men with thick, squarish beards and hats who seemed clones of Renoir and Manet.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I love that. So I think it's probably time to take questions from you and from whoever is out there in the digital world. And I'm sure Pankaj won't mind answering questions which don't completely allied with what you may not yet have read or heard today?
I just figured someone should ask a question. No. Pankaj, in a lot of your non-fiction, you, and perhaps particularly in Age of Anger, you're...
Could you speak up?
I wanted to ask you about hope, I think, because I think on the sort of political left, we often feel like we have the answers, right? But we don't have the power. And you can disagree with that, obviously. And maybe I would too. But I increasingly have sort of conversations with people where, you know, we're all feeling very bleak about what's happening and what's going to happen. And I'm not asking you to say, it's okay, man, it's going to be all right. But maybe I am. But so I wanted to ask about that. Is it sort of, what do you think about hope, and do you feel hopeless?
I don't actually feel hopeless. I think especially when I hear questions like that. I mean, I think it's awkward for me to talk to younger people about this, including my own daughter, because I'm very aware that my generation has, I mean, I think one could put it very bluntly, has screwed up the world in all kinds of ways and really given you a terrible inheritance, very little to play with, very little to work with. I feel certainly, I think what my generation can do at this point, or people in my generation, is to make way and sort of, you know, make way for a younger generation to do the kind of things that we've been doing, which includes writing, which includes thinking, which includes political engagement. Because as I keep saying, I think we've lived through three decades of intense ideological indoctrination, which you've been spared because you've grown up in a time of adversity. We grew up at a time when things were looking very good for all of us. And certainly, you know, people of my generation were there at the right time, including characters in this novel, to embrace those opportunities. But those opportunities are not available now, not just for Indians, but for most people elsewhere. So I think, you know, in that sense, but that's why, I mean, that's a source of my awkwardness, that here I'm sitting as a beneficiary of three decades of deep inequality, era marked by, you know, every kind of injustice, of course, rendered invisible by ideology. And I feel like hope can really emerge from the kind of engagement that a younger generation brings, you know, whether to politics or to literature. I think we've had our say, and we've done our bit, which was, you know, it turns out not very much, probably very damaging in the long term. I don't know if that answers your question, but I do see hope. I've not been damaging, maybe not. Who knows?
Wait till we hear what his children say. So I'm older than Pankaj, and I could say to you that there's definitely hope. I mean, you know, Pankaj has said we had a good run. We did have a good run. But when I remember the 70s, it seemed as if we were about to have nuclear war. people were poor, garbage everywhere in the streets, we didn't have electricity half the week. I mean, so things were pretty gloomy. And then things seem to get better again. I don't think I've changed my political positions very much, but you know, stuff happens. It's not always dependent on individuals in quite that way, although we do have something to say with it, certainly in the smaller realm. So yes to hope, even today. It's not a good day for hope.
I have a question here from Luke in cyberspace. Luke asks, you have commented elsewhere that your novel is in a way in conversation with a bend in the river, while some of the passages read out today are reminiscent of the Mimic Men. My Paul is another writer concerned with migrants in the midst of epochal change. Is yours the same epochal change that he wrote about, or a new one?
Definitely a new one, but I think it's impossible to get away from my Paul. I think he's a writer who, in every kind of way, not only as a personal example of a writer coming from very unpromising set of circumstances, nevertheless, who makes himself a writer. And I think Amitabha, many other writers, would attest to the force and of his example. But I think in other ways, the exploration of the post-colonial world after the 1950s and 60s, the world of India, the world of Indonesia, many, many, many different worlds in Asia and Africa, and the conclusions that he draws both in his fiction and nonfiction, those are conclusions you can violently disagree with, you can agree with, whatever you do with them, you can never ignore them. So you have to reckon with, and you know, I very consciously put this conversation, put this novel in conversation with A Bend in the River, because that I think in many ways now that is emerging as is probably his most complex novel about, you know, the fate of many, many post-colonial societies, just what has happened there, what is the relationship with the past of those societies. And this is something I think this novel also grapples with, what happens when you're in a great hurry to disown that particular past and to embrace ideologies of modernity. There are two Naipauls, obviously. There's a Naipaul of nonfiction, there's a Naipaul of the fiction. And I think the fiction is far more complex and far more rewarding in the end. And I think in that sense, the Mimic Man has to be also part of this conversation, because it's again about the colonial's encounter with, as Lisa put in the introduction, the relationship between the metropolis and the periphery. Those tensions are, again, I think very few people have written about them as engagingly and rewardingly as Naipaul.
One of the running themes throughout your work is the corrupting and co-opting power of the market. So, for instance, probably my favorite line in End of Suffering was, it was as if a society prodigiously organized for expansion and consumption could absorb everything, even the few individuals who had once stood opposed to it. And a lot of your takedowns, which I love, are basically about hypocrisy and selling out. And I'm curious, how do you reconcile the fact that you yourself are a successful participant in this mechanism you criticize? You know, for example, you can be unaware of the fact that the spectacle of you and Niall Ferguson knifing each other in public is good for both yours and Niall Ferguson's sales.
It's, you know, I suppose we're all tainted in some way or other. Hard to avoid that. And I think best to admit that, that, you know, if you are kind of, you know, working essentially not very far away from this particular marketplace you describe, then at, you know, some level or other, you will be compromised too. You know, I have also published in magazines and periodicals owned by Rupert Murdoch. I think that's probably the biggest sinner that I've committed. And there are others, you know, other hypocrisies that I'm certainly very, very guilty of. But I think at the same time, I feel like those hypocrisies have not been large enough to compromise, you know, the things I've written, not entirely compromise them, perhaps. And, you know, that is my kind of modest hope.
Read the novel.
This is a two-part question, but if one part is irrelevant, just ignore. So I love your analysis in Age of Anger of this resentment as a global phenomenon. And from what you've read, the novel picks up similar themes. But I'm not sure I'm exactly adding a note of skepticism, but it strikes me that in the immediate present, I wonder if some of this is changing, because, you know, in Britain today, outside of this room, nobody cares whether you've read Proust, I think. I mean, if you want social status, you buy a Premier League football club. I mean, canonical culture has lost a lot of its status. If you Google image V.S. Naipaul 80th birthday party 2015, maybe you were there. I mean, there are a lot of guests there, George Osborne, Geordie Gregg, a lot of celebrities and so on. Which contemporary novelist would that be the case in Britain or anywhere else? And secondly, I wonder, your defense on the LRB blog of fiction was very interesting. It's something that many writers sort of have been denigrating for a long time, the idea that fiction can confront contemporary realities in quite that way. So,
have they been denigrating? I mean, who were you thinking
of?
Well,
I guess the idea that fiction has sort of become redundant over the past 20 years in terms of confronting experience, mediatized experience, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely that idea. I don't know whether, you know, people seriously believe in it or believe in it strongly enough to actually stop writing, because everyone is attempting to write the internet novel, for instance, you know, to take on board the way the internet is interfering or maybe messing up our inner lives or cognitive abilities or our private relationships and so on and so forth. But I mean, I think it is true that the world has certainly become a far more unmanageable place than it was before, when we were all living in relatively self-sufficient, isolated societies. You know, the world that I'm describing in the early pages of this novel is a world where you are getting the news literally a day late through the newspaper. So it's much, much more difficult to take on board. I mean, I found it difficult, you know, going back to the novel with all this experience of 20 years of globalization behind me. But I think there are still ways to cut through that, to cut through the noise. And, you know, in the end, what is the novel concerned with? I think if the novel is concerned with human personality, it's concerned with consciousness, the unfolding of human personality. And human personality is always a mysterious thing. And that's why it's at some level, it's so strange that we should pick up a novel. Why are we picking up a novel to immerse ourselves in the life experience of some other individuals that we don't know, have never met? But we do it because we are genuinely fascinated by other lives. We want to know about them, about their consciousness, or how they have responded to the world that we live in. And I feel like if you start with that, I think it's possible. It's actually possible to also, you know, bring in this unmanageable data that we are constantly assaulted with, and to also put it in the novel without turning the novel itself into something unmanageable. What was your earlier point about ressentiment, about Naipaul's birthday party? I should look up that Google image. That sounds bad.
Forgot to invite you.
Is this the same one where the Rothschilds are also probably present? Probably. Yeah.
Any more questions? Digital?
You've departed from nonfiction to fiction. You know, we love the romantics. You know, you've ended up back in a place where you're writing fiction. Is it a departure, or is it a feeling that you wanted to get something out that you couldn't get in nonfiction? Who are your influences? You know, who are going to inspire the young guys that obviously have inspired you?
I mean, it's definitely a, you know, exhilarating feeling. I mean, I think I've bored my wife and daughter about this a lot, about, you know, just how I've enjoyed writing this book far, far more than I've enjoyed writing any other book or all the other books combined. So it's been really, in that sense, you know, sometimes I wonder, although I should not say this before my publisher or my agent, whether I'll ever go back to nonfiction, because I feel that this has allowed me to write about a whole lot of things that I couldn't do in nonfiction. And going back to nonfiction again means going back to formula. It means going back to observing certain protocols, constraints on your imagination. Oh, there are a lot of people doing very good stuff out there. You know, I will not be missed. I will not be missed, I assure you. And I think I probably, as I keep saying, I should also make way. When people ask me to write nonfiction today, I recommend a younger writer, because I really do feel very strongly that people like me should be thinking of retirement. We should make way for younger people. I mean, I sometimes feel slightly ashamed of, you know, still sitting there squatting in these, you know, positions which should be vacated for other people, for younger people. I feel ashamed that people are still writing me to asking me to write, or magazine editors are asking me to commissioning me to write about certain things when they should be commissioning younger people. So I'm in the way, and I should, you know, get out.
soon.
So you think of fiction as a retirement plan?
It is very much a retirement plan. It's a way of moving gracefully, you know, towards the Dormark exit, you know.
Okay, I'm going to write a novel next. Any more questions?
Thank you for a very interesting discussion. I had a question about ambiguity, and I got a real sense of ambiguity, of being able to hold contradictory beliefs quite comfortably in a way that perhaps we aren't able to do in the wider world outside of certain circles. And I wonder what your thoughts are on perhaps a new role of fiction in bringing the important role of ambiguity back into the real world.
Well, I think it's particularly important in this instance, because at these, there are many ways of answering that, I suppose, but I'm thinking more of the characters in this book who are all being trained in a particular way to be engineers, to be men of science. And it's this interesting phenomenon that some of the biggest supporters, or certainly the most aggressive, strident supporters of Hindu nationalism in India, happen to have tech backgrounds. And I think there is a reason there, that none of them really have been trained. Their positions are so strident, they're so partisan in their thinking, so driven to a kind of binary thinking about issues. And one of the reasons is that they've never been sufficiently exposed to the role of ambiguity in human affairs. And that can only come, I'm afraid, through exposure to literature. So if you start at the age of 12, which is what many of these people do, to, you know, deepen your knowledge of science, of physics, and keep doing that for the next 10, 15 years at least, before you get a, you know, very good job, then you're basically very, very detached from the world where things are not clear-cut at all. And that is the realm that we all inhabit, where the rule is contradiction, it's doubt, it's uncertainty. And so I think in that sense, you know, what fiction does, and I mean, again, journalism deals too much with a certain kind, especially journalism now, because you're up against it, you're up against all kinds of malicious fictions being floated by demagogues, podcasters, YouTubers, so you're up against it. So you also fall into the trap of speaking unambiguously about certain things, you also fall into the trap of taking set positions, which often turn out to be very shakily grounded. So I feel like it's only really fiction where you can give back to ambiguity its central place in human affairs.
I think you should go and talk to our Department of Education and point out to our various ministers responsible for schools that the STEM subjects may not be enough or not in the way they're taught. Yeah, sorry, there was a question over there. That's very good, Pankaj. I mean, that's so true.
Thank you. It's really building on the last question, but I was just wondering if the, you know, returning to fiction after such a long period of time, perhaps being forced by that challenge to sympathise with people with a wide range of perspectives, whether that had actually changed any of your political views at all?
Probably not, because I think, again, the reality of political confrontation today is such, political antagonism is such, that I think any kind of weakness, for instance, can be quite fatal to your position. I think it's important to hold positions. And I think, you know, going back to your earlier question, I really do think we are in a very, very desperate situation. And every day brings fresh evidence of that, where I feel that, you know, I have to disconnect my imaginative, my life as a writer of imaginative prose from, you know, my political life and, you know, the political life that I pursue in my journalism, in my fiction, you know, my taking particular positions on certain issues. It does certainly broaden, as you say, the range of sympathies that I have, helps me to understand particular positions and perspectives. But there are certain positions that are non-negotiable. I mean, you know, you have to be against mendacity or you have to be against racism. And, you know, I'm not going to be compromising on those particular positions. Maybe I'll have a broader understanding of where a certain form of racism is coming from, particularly the more insidious varieties of racism. But it's not, you know, I'm not going to give up my opposition to those malign things.
Thank you, Pankaj. We're going to take one more question online.
We have another online one. This is from Apurva. Does secularism, which itself was an illusion in the past, stand a chance in today's India? Is there opposition to Hindu nationalism and Brahmin authoritarianism?
I think, you know, unfortunately, Brahminism as an ideology, Brahminism as a kind of caste affiliation has made a massive comeback. People are very proud to proclaim themselves Brahmins and upper caste. And I think in that context, the invocation of secularism is not gonna do it. I think we should all be thinking more of pluralism. I think pluralism is probably a better platform in a sense, because as the questioner himself admitted, secularism has been revealed too much as an ideology of, you know, of the elites, and I think been discredited as a result. Whereas pluralism has much older traditions in India and indeed everywhere else. You know, the discussion the other day about the, you know, Jews in Baghdad or elsewhere, these were all pluralist societies, which then start turned the against week. On this was on Start the Week. And pluralism has been the biggest victim in the last, you know, 40, 50 years of nationalist consolidation. And secularism in that sense has been revealed as a sort of very narrow ideology of a privileged elite, whereas pluralism is a reality that exists all across the social hierarchy.
But you can't have a pluralism with objective choice exams or engineering degrees.
Yes.
It's very difficult because there's one answer. Anyhow, I think there was one last question there. If it's a short one, we'll take it. But otherwise, we really should stop.
I just wanted to know, do you have any recommendations for younger writers who should be... Do you have any recommendations for younger writers that you were talking about that we should read probably?
Oh, you know, whenever people ask me for recommendations, I recommend a whole lot of Australian writers. And this is partly because I feel like they are the most neglected group of writers in the world. And they keep on producing, you know, one world-class writer after another. And yet, you know, they continue to be neglected. I'm not entirely sure whether, I mean, I think I'm most of them could be read with great profit by younger readers. And one of them, I saw her book, she has a new book out called Michelle de Kretzer, who I think is one of the, you know, most interesting, most original writer working today. She has a new novel out. It's actually, you know, you should look her other books up as well. There is Gail Jones, another Australian writer of, you know, again, you know, really sort of breathtaking originality. There are also older Australian writers that I'm constantly talking about to no avail. But, you know, also I feel there are a whole lot of writers who've been neglected. They were once very well known and are not now sort of fallen into critical neglect, such as Nadine Gordimer, who I think... increasingly now, she seems to me the peer of Naipaul in many ways. Maybe, you know, sometimes, maybe I think if you look at her achievement as a whole, I think it probably exceeds Naipaul's achievement. But definitely worth returning to, because here is a writer who wrote living under an explicitly white supremacist regime. So a lot of the conversation today about historical injustices, about racial injustices or white supremacy in general, I think that itself would be a good reason to sort of read her novels today. But I think what would be an even more compelling reason is that she was a great artist. And, you know, you can only envy the way she, you know, sets a scene, conjures up an atmosphere, describes or picks up little details. So in every way, aesthetically, politically, intellectually, reading her books is a sort of enthralling experience. So, you know, I can give you some more
I'm going to stop you there, Pankaj, because we could be here all night with our favorite writers. There are a lot of books. Look around. Thank you all for being here. Pankaj, thank you so much. Please buy this book. It's a treat. And thank you, David.
And thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.